Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode has been brought to you by Sake Man, a group of sake superheroes bringing sake to the world.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And today, we're going to be talking about some very special food. Supra, or a feast. And then again, all the food of the Republic of Georgia. Situated strategically at the crossroads of Europe and Asia sits an ancient land on the Caucasus mountain range. It is the Republic of Georgia, a veritable market basket of agricultural bounty. And Georgia has a unique ancient cultural heritage that's famed for its traditions of hospitality and cuisine. 25 years ago, award-winning author, cookbook author, Dara Goldstein, introduced a generation of cooks to the culture and cuisine of that land in her book, The Georgian Feast. And today, Georgia has become Georgia has become a very hot travel destination for both its beautiful land and its food and wine traditions. Fortunately for us, Dara has an updated anniversary edition of the Georgian Feast that's just been released and once again brings the marvels and tastes of that rich country to all of us. And she's here with me today to discuss the food of the Republic of Georgia. Welcome, Dara.
Thanks, Linda. I'm always thrilled to talk to you.
I keep thinking of Georgia as a person. But
I know, well. It's so hard. It's a problematic name, I have to say, because you always have to say Georgia, and then you have to explain
it. Well, in fact, they say just Georgia now, not the Republic of Georgia. Is that correct? I mean, now that, well, they've been independent for a while.
It's getting there.
Yeah. Dara, I want to tell our readers a little bit about you, even though you have been a frequent visitor to my show. Dara is the Wilcox B. and Harriet M. Adsit Professor of Russian Emerita at Williams College, and she was a founding editor of Gastronomica, the Journal of Food and Culture, which was named the 2012 Publication of the Year by the James Beard Foundation. She's published widely on literature, culture, art, and cuisine, and has organized several exhibitions on graphic design and having to do with food and tools of the table. And she is the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. You were on to talk about that as well. And the author of 5 award-winning cookbooks. In addition to that, Dara currently serves on the kitchen cabinet at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History and on the advisory board of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. So it is with great pleasure once again that I welcome you, Dara. In this new edition of your book, The Georgian Feast, which I thought, oh, well, I'll just look through it because that's the same book that it's different. You actually revised it and wrote some beautiful introductory chapters or sections. And in that opening section, you wrote, Georgian hospitality supersedes all the political strife. Describe to me when your writing of this book and the original book, the changes that, all the changes that Georgia was going through at the time, previous changes, new changes. Then you went in and rewrote the book and you had another edition come out, in 2000?
Yeah, that was a slightly updated, so this one's really revised,
so
and I added new recipes.
Right, so many changes. Tell me a little bit about what's been going on there.
Okay, this is a short version because we don't have time for the entire history. But I first visited Georgia in the late 1970s, which certainly dates me, but it was very much a part of the Soviet Union then. And going there from Moscow was like going to Shangri-La. Mm. I mean, there was sun, there were fruits, there was joyousness, particularly in the winter time. And I was absolutely enthralled by this culture and by the flavors, the intensity of the flavors, and by the rituals of the table. I think that was what was so striking. When I went back again, having decided to write a cookbook, it was during, it was right at the beginning of what turned into a civil war in Georgia, when the region called Abkhazia, there was a lot of strife there. There were people with machine guns in the streets. There was fighting. And in the thick of all this, we were still regaled with extraordinary feasts because the Georgians, throughout their history, since the land is so lush and it has been on the trade route from the Far East to Istanbul, people have wanted to conquer it, and they have been subjugated a number of times. But they understand something larger that they want to celebrate. So the hospitality for me became the through line to this book. And then, of course, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. Georgia became independent, but there was civil war. There was a lot of chaos. But now it is pretty much back on its feet.
Yeah, little pressures from places here and there. But
yeah,
I mean, I am just amazed. It's my next place to go and visit, and I will be referring to this book often. But I'm amazed that it kind of is this microcosm of all different agricultural regions. I mean, tropical to northern cold cheese making mountainous
sheep
herding.
It's not much larger than South Carolina, if you can picture South Carolina. But it goes from the Black Sea, which is subtropical, up to the mountains, areas like Svaneti and Tusheti, which are in the Caucasus, so really high peaks. Yeah. And there's so much mythology tied up with it, too. So Mount Elbrus is apparently where Prometheus was chained, right, and where fire began. So there are these beautiful stories that are tied up with it. And then, of course, in the eastern part is the primary winemaking region called Kakheti. And that would be comparable to what we think of as, say, Napa Valley, even though they're making wine throughout the country. And the winemaking tradition there is 8,000 years old.
Yeah, I was kind of dating it back to Alice Fearing wrote that beautiful essay in your book as well on the wine culture
which
the history of the wine.
Is really
culture.
Ancient. And if we think of our word wine, it probably goes, even though Georgian has its own language and it is not related to any of the other languages that we know, their word for wine, kvino, is probably where wine, vine, va, and all of those came from.
Yeah, interesting. And even the similarities of ancients, the same thing, using the ancients, we call them the amphora in the Western world and civilization, but they call them the
Kvevri. And you if you think of the amphora, it's usually something that you're carrying or transporting above ground. The Kvevri are actually buried in the ground, and that's where the wine is fermented.
Keep it cool.
And then stored,
Wow, that's interesting. So many interesting traditions. I mean, the culture itself dates back to like 600 BC, no?
Yeah, I'm never very good with my centuries BC.
You wrote it, so I'm repeating.
Okay, so if I said that, I do fact check myself.
Okay, good.
But yeah, and accepted Christianity in the 5th century, and their alphabet is very ancient. They had their renaissance in the 12th century under Queen Tamar, who is in Georgian referred to as King Tamar. So there's this wonderful tradition of really strong women there too, which I love.
But it's just the terrain and the fruits and vegetables. It really vegetable forward. Cuisine in many ways.
It is. People eat a lot of meat now simply because this is modern times and people in general are more affluent. But yes, it's very much plant-based.
You talked about all the turmoil initially, the incursions. And in fact, you mentioned the word that they use for hello rather than hello. It's the word for victory.
Yeah, and when you make a toast, Garmar Jos, it means victory.
Victory, so they're used
but
to
not,
winning. Right?
Yeah, although I wouldn't... When we say victory in English, there's something militaristic about it, but it, I don't know, culturally it just sounds more beautiful in Georgian. Sorry.
Maybe it's just, we'll just think of it as freedom, you know, or something. How best would you describe the... Or could you ascribe a taste, a particular taste or flavor to Georgian cuisine?
Yeah, I think about that a lot. And what struck me is how distinctive it is. So you have Turkey to the west, you have Armenia, Azerbaijan, you have the North Caucasus and Russia to the north. So it has all of these very interesting culinary cultures around it, and yet it has retained its own flavor. And one of the things that makes it distinctive is the spice mixture that you could say is somewhat comparable to, say, curry powder in India. So no one really uses curry powder as such, right. But there are lots of different spices that go into it. And the Georgians have this wonderful mixture of spices called khmeli suneli, mixed spice, that... taken together and used in different combinations, give this Georgian flavor. So it's things, what we particularly don't know is blue fenugreek. And they also use something that they call Imeretian saffron. So Imereti is a region in the central part of Georgia. And it's actually dried marigold petals.
I was going to say, they use a lot of dried marigolds, right? Yeah, I didn't know
so
that that's what it was.
It's beautiful because, like turmeric, it gives this golden color to food, but it also gives this really redolent, earthy flavor. Mm. And then you have coriander, you have dill, sometimes basil, sometimes caraway. There are all kinds of things you can add. But so it's quite aromatic. The western part of the country really likes spicy food, so you have a lot of chili pepper, whereas in the east it's a much gentler flavor. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I think is very characteristic is, and you find this in Persian cuisine, just platters and platters of fresh herbs.
Right.
When they make a lamb stew, for instance, or another kind of stew, or say a soup with beef in it, the last 5 minutes, you put copious amounts of herbs. I mean, cupfuls and cupfuls of chopped herbs. So cilantro, dill, fresh basil, especially tarragon. They really love tarragon. And you let it steam for just 5 minutes. And so the herbs don't cook down into, you know, brownness.
Right.
But they make everything incredibly aromatic.
And then there's always just a platter of fresh herbs to eat along with whatever you're eating, right?
Yes.
It's just, yeah, I was always amazed at that, the couple of dinners that, you know, that I have been to and experienced. And I am totally addicted to ajika.
Oh.
I think I just finished up the last. I made it, well, of course, when I made it, I made so much. I made vats of it. It was Naomi DeGood's recipe.
Oh, okay.
And made a whole vat of it, and it made I don't know how many quart jars.
And you finished it. I'm impressed.
Yeah, you bet. I gave some away.
Okay.
To, you know,
that's the Georgian equivalent of salsa for listeners who don't know.
Yes.
And it can be like a paste, or else it can be more liquidy like a salsa, and it accompanies meat and other dishes.
And initially very, very spicy. But I will tell you that you know, the jars were kept for a while and then refrigerated.
Mm-hmm.
They're not processed. And by the end of the time, a year later, it was it had lost
mellowed.
A lot of it. Yeah, it mellowed out. And I said, I can't put enough in. But it's delicious, yeah. I mean, the flavors, as you mentioned, when you were mentioning the spices, the fenugreek and the dried marigolds, I was thinking of all these things that went into it. It was just so packed with
the
flavor.
The other thing that is important in Georgian is that you have this wonderful balance of sour as well. And they use a native plum called tkemali, and that is also a sauce that's frequently used. So you have the spicy ajika, or you have the tkemali. And it's a plum sauce that is seasoned with herbs and some spices. And it's also a counterpart to many of the very rich dairy dishes, which we haven't even talked about, and particularly the one that is sort of the rage all over the place now, which is khachapuri.
Yeah.
You know, khachapuri.
All right. So you have to tell everybody what khachapuri if you're not, you know, traditional.
Well, it's cheese bread. And so when I wrote this book 25 years ago, I was sort of looking for investors. I was saying, this is the next great pizza. And no one was paying attention. But now you can find so much khachapuri. And basically,
all varieties everywhere.
It is cheese stuffed into dough. And there are so many different varieties, different kinds of dough. It can be done in a griddle, it can be done in a wood-fired oven, it can be done in a regular oven. They use a cheese called sulguni, which is a cow's cheese that is salty. I usually use a mixture of Havarti and feta, but you can mix things up. It's very oozy. The one that is all over Instagram is the Ajarian. Ajaruli Hachapuri, which looks like a boat.
A boat, shaped like a boat.
And you have tons of cheese inside, and then you break an egg on it, and you mix the egg in, and it's just cholesterol city, but it will...
But it's
a meal
in itself.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, when I asked you how would you, and that was your excellent description of the flavors, bring it down to the spice mixtures, because, I mean, I often think of it as kind of very Persian or very Turkish, the whole area. I don't know, somehow, you know, it was hard for me to identify it being, you know, part of the, when it was under the Soviet rule in the Soviet era. It is so unique unto itself that...
Yeah, the other thing I forgot to mention, so when you say Turkey and Persia, what is... I keep saying, oh, this is what's most distinctive about Georgian cuisine, but what is its use of walnuts.
Yes. Yes.
So we, in America, we think of walnuts, you add them to brownies or to cookies, or you don't use them regularly in savory form. Occasionally, but it's not our go-to.
Mm-hmm.
And in Georgia, it's a very intrinsic part of a lot of dishes. The classic one would be what's called tsatsivi, which is a ground walnut sauce. But a lot of their vegetable purees, like I have a couple wonderful recipes for these purees, which can be made with beets or eggplant or leeks, right. And you grind the walnuts and you add fresh herbs and you add spices. And it's just a beautiful, very healthy puree, lots of omega-3s in the walnuts.
New party dip, people.
Yeah. And it gives a richness to the food without it being cloying. And they also used to use walnut oil exclusively. So now I do it in the food processor, for which I always reproach myself, but I cannot stand there with a mortar and pestle to get all the walnut oil out and then pound and pound and pound the nuts, but that's how they used to do it.
Well, it's interesting because one of my new I never thought it, I was, when I saw the recipe, a couple of years ago, for a dish with eggplant and walnuts, you know, pounded together. I thought, I don't know if I'm going to like it. It is my new favorite combination, the walnuts and eggplant combination.
That's one of the new recipes I added to the book.
Oh.
Because I had the beet puree, and I had variations, but I didn't have an eggplant one.
Yeah. It's just, it's very interesting, the interesting combinations. That's why I always think of it. It has this, I don't know, to me, more... For being such rustic countryside, yet it's more in the northern mountain area, more Middle Eastern, more Turkish. Mm-hmm. It has, I guess, and it's just all in the use of all the herbs and spices. You know.
One of the things I really would love to trace someday is if you look at just the word khachapuri, puri is obviously Hindi. The Hindi word for bread. They have another fabulous dish called chicken tabaka, which has since become... a classic part of Russian repertoire as well, because people love it so much. And it's basically the same as, chicken under a brick. It's been split, spatchcocked, and then grilled, usually on a cast iron skillet. And the word tapha is a Hindi word from, you know, northern India. Hmm. And so I really think that on the trade routes, a lot was coming from India, and that connection needs to be followed.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, it's wonderful because they've been either through the different wars and, you know, incursions and or spice travel or, you know, travelers. They've embraced a lot of these other cultures.
They've embraced, but they haven't lost what was theirs. They've kept intact.
That's very important. We're going to take a short break. And when we do, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the traditions and practices of the food, particularly the northern regions and cheese, as you said, and maybe southern fruit. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Sake Man. What is Sake Man? Sake Man are judo athletes wearing Lucha Libre-inspired masks that act as sake heroes. This team of athletes moonlight as sake educational professionals spreading sake to the world. Learn more about their mission and their favorite sakes at saketotheworld.com. That's saketotheworld.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio has plenty more. Hi, I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I'm the host of Feast Your Ears here on HRN. My show explores the world of food through storytelling. Every week, I talk with people inside and outside the food world about how experience has shaped what they eat and cook. You can find Feast Your Ears wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Dara Goldstein, who has written, well, it's actually... The publishers have put a new edition out, a 25th anniversary edition, and with a lot of added essays by Dara, called The Georgian Feast. And we've been talking, you were talking so much about walnuts and the inclusion of walnuts, but not only walnuts, there's hazelnuts and almonds, a lot of nuts growing. I'm just amazed at the bounty of what they grow. But we would be remiss if we didn't discuss, I like to call them church keys, but it's not church keys. Churchkella. Churchkella. I call them church keys because church keys. I can never remember Churchkella.
That's a good mnemonic.
Right. But describe them because they are just, they're wonderful.
I'm sorry. I'm going to say something that just came to mind. I have an Iranian friend and I was describing Churchkella to him and he said, "Oh, in Iran, we called those judges pricks."
Okay, church key or judge's prick, whatever
yeah,
you
Yeah, exactly. So basically, you take walnuts, sometimes hazelnuts, but walnuts are classic, and you thread them on a string or on some sturdy twine. And then you dip it repeatedly in fresh grape juice.
Kind of like candle making, right?
It is like candle making. And you've thickened it a little bit with cornstarch so that it will stick. And you just dip and dip and dip until you have this beautiful long string of grape-coated walnuts.
But but you have to understand, I'll post a picture of it. They're packed in really close together.
Yeah, and so it's a confection. And then you slice it into rounds, and it's a little bit chewy. So it is like having dried fruit, except there's a nut in the center, and you pull the string out. Obviously, you don't eat the string. But they're sold on the roadsides or in the market, and you see many different colors because you can use different grapes, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And so you have this range from burgundy to a kind of mahogany to something that's more golden, and it's quite beautiful. The Georgians don't have a real repertoire of baked goods and sweets the way we understand it, but they eat the churchkella. They have a lot of fresh fruit, and they do have some baked goods, but it's not really their...
Well, it also preserves the walnuts, does it not?
It does.
So they
absolutely.
Yeah, they last a long time.
Yeah.
They don't get rancid. They stay preserved. And it's great. I'll try to find a photograph that I can post it because it looks like a beaded curtain. If you see them standing on the roadside, it looks like a beaded curtain of all these strings of of dipped walnuts.
Yeah.
Just marvelous. I did say that I wanted to talk about northern reaches and then the southern tropical or subtropical. Like milk products and cheese really were not eaten in a lot of the parts, even though they were that close, because it was only made up in the northern region. Is that correct? Or is that...
No, they were making fresh cheese. So the Sulgoni is a fresher cheese. They were making, or and still are, making aged cheese in the mountains. And that tends to be sheep's milk that they use instead of cow's milk, because obviously they're pasturing the sheep there. There's an area called Tusheti in the High Caucasus that is very remote and very wild. And the very traditional way of making this cheese was to age it in a wineskin, which, you know, was basically you take the sheep and you slaughter it, and you clean it and you turn it inside out, and you actually have the fur on the inside, and you put the fresh cheese in there and let it age. And I know it sounds a little off-putting, but it is very sharp and quite wonderful. It's called, they call it Gouda.
They call it Gouda.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, it has nothing to do with the Dutch cheese, but so that's a very traditional cheese.
Well, so they turn it inside out and you're putting it against the...
Yeah, so it's getting a lot of different bacteria that help it to age.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that is interesting. What I... there are all of these references to different plants that grow, and they keep mentioning eucalyptus all the time. Eucalyptus grown. Is there a lot of eucalyptus grown?
Yeah, it's not. That's in the subtropical areas, and it's not native, and it's not really part of what I think of when I think of Georgia.
However, in some of those subtropical regions and other regions, there are fruits that you don't hear a lot about here in the Western culture.
My favorite is probably... I'm not even sure how to pronounce it in English. Feijoa.
Feijoa.
Yeah.
I would say feijoa.
I learned to say it feijoa. And I first tasted it in Georgia. And what they did there, besides just eating it fresh, and it is, I don't know, flavor somewhat like a cross between passion fruit and pineapple. I mean, it's just got this tropical flavor. It's so exquisite and so aromatic. But they were just...
About as big as your fist, sort of, or...?
Maybe a little bigger than my fist, but my husband's fist, perhaps. Grind it with sugar to preserve it, and or you can make a jam out of it, or just eat it plain. It's not usually used in cooking. The fruit that they use most in cooking, it would be plums, but also quince.
Quince. What about medlar? And they?
Not really.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting that to read about all these, to me, exotic, you know, fruits being grown. And, of course, because they have this abundance of fruit, and you say they don't have a real culture of baked goods or so much, they use the fruits and they preserve it, and they make fruit leather, right?
Yes, tlapi, it's called. And the classic one would be made from the plum. And again, you see those in a whole range of different flavors. They also use apricots a lot for that. And you can roll it up the way you would find fruit leather sold here in the States, or just have pieces that you tear off and add to soups or stews to give that little bit of sourness.
Soury sweetness. Yeah.
Again, to mitigate the richness of the stew, it just adds that beautiful note of sour and fruitiness that's, I think, makes the dish transcend what it would just be without it.
Interesting. You mentioned that they are eating more meats now, but... And everything seems to be cooked outside. Well, in fact, this whole culture that you describe of living outside.
Yes, well, they like to tie that to the myth of Prometheus. Like, this is the way we're supposed to cook. But it's true. There's I mean, it sounds cliched to say that there's this deep connection with nature, but they really love to feast. And in the first edition of the book, I had a lot of reproductions of this wonderful Georgian neo-primitivist artist named Niko Pirosmani. And he so he was from the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. Beautiful scenes of people feasting outdoors. But what is significant is that they always spread a tablecloth. The word for tablecloth in Georgian is supra.
Oh, that's
and that
where, so
became the metonymy for feast. The feast.
Yeah.
So there, it's always ritualized. But the food, well, as you know, always tastes better outdoors.
Outside, right.
And not just the grilling, which tends to be the man's job, as it is in many cultures, but they also have these beautiful clay pots that are only about, say, 2 inches high, and they stack them over a fire, and food inside both bakes and steams at the same time. Mm. So they do mushrooms that way. These are called ketsi. And they also bake, in the western part of the country, they bake cornbread these. So
it's like a steam basket, like a stacked steam.
It's like a steam basket, yeah. Except that it's done over an open fire without water.
Hmm. Interesting. Tell me about some of the feasts. I mean, there's an important person involved in all the feasts.
Yes, the tamada.
Yes.
That's the toast. I mean, we call Toastmaster, but that doesn't begin to describe the artistry of the Toastmaster in Georgia. Traditionally, it's a man. And there used to be schools where you went because it's not just, oh, let's raise a toast to so-and-so. It's really creating a sense of continuity with the past and remembering everything that Georgia has been and will continue to be. As a nation, as a country where people still believe in a Georgian ideal. And the other important function is sort of as a newscaster, which again gives the wrong impression in English, but you have a gathering around a table, and the Toastmaster needs to know who has had a loss or who has had a success. And throughout the evening, and these feasts go on for hours, and there's always wine poured for each toast, so it's quite a ritualized thing. But the Toastmaster will announce so-and-so, let's drink to so-and-so because. And so it's a way of sharing news, of giving support to people, of celebrating, but also mourning with someone. And it creates a sense of kinship.
Hmm. And, so, then, and there are many of these throughout a feast, I would imagine.
Many, many, many. And it's also poetry. It's not just brief, but it's highly poetic. And then there are intermezzos throughout the feast as more food is brought in and people spontaneously break into song. And Georgian singing is just, a cappella singing is extraordinary. So that's an important part of the feast too.
And are they generally folk tales? They tell, the songs tell stories, or are they
Yeah.
The feasts in the past, I mean, they would probably involve the whole town, I would imagine. But the history of the feasts, what was there a reason? I mean, they just was a way of gathering. People ate communally. They had a communal oven. Why? What was the bringing together?
Can you
think about that?
I don't know that it involved entire communities from the start. I really think it is more families and relatives and friends and sort of expanding out like that. But again, it's a way of affirming friendship, affirming love, affirming unity, especially in the face of all of these incursions over the centuries.
So tell me what would be served.
Well, one of the things I always found extraordinary was I was brought up in a household where you serve each course and you clear the course before you bring the next course. And in Georgia, when you approach the table, everything that you think is going to be for the feast is spread out on the table. So these are all the things that we would think of as appetizers. But they would be the different vegetable purees, the walnut stuffed eggplant rolls that we were just talking about during the break, beautiful breads that have been baked in the Georgian oven, which is called a tonneau.
Yeah, describe that.
It's again, one of these words that makes me think, oh, India, yeah. Tandoor. It's basically the same thing. So it's a big clay oven.
And again, it's called the
tonneau. T-O-N-E, but mm-hmm. Tonneau. And bread dough is slapped against the sides of the hot clay. The classic Georgian loaf is called shoti. And what's beautiful about it is that it has a thick central part, and then it tapers to narrower ends so that you can have both the soft crumb, if that's what you like, or the crisp ends.
Crust.
Yeah, so you can have a happy marriage. Yeah. So you have the bread and just so many different dishes. Mm. But then soup might be brought in. Khachapuri, hot from the oven, might be brought in. Or another kind of stuffed pie. They also stuff it with mashed beans or sometimes potatoes or greens. Or there's a beautiful stuffed meat pie from the western part of the country called Svaneti that is known as Kubdari, which is one of my favorites. And as all of these dishes are brought out, they're progressively stacked upon one upon the other. And then the main courses come out, which might be grilled meats or a beautiful stew or, the satsivi, the chicken in the walnut sauce, would have come out earlier. So by the end of the table, it is towering. Hmm. And you also have wine bottles. And you have soda. They make a tarragon soda that they often serve that's bright green. And it's, to the eye, it is absolutely abundant, but also chaotic if you grew up in a household like I did.
Well, we have to talk about wine. Wine is so much a part of their culture. And now it's becoming, again, another hot topic and hot property and very popular. And that's the natural wine, or the orange wine, as we call it.
So the Georgians have been making, I like to call it amber instead of orange.
Yes.
I just think it's a nicer word.
Right. And more accurately descriptive.
They put the freshly squeezed juice into this kvevri, clay amphora, along with the stems and the skins, and oxidation occurs, and so it takes on this really beautiful color. And that's a traditional way of winemaking, and it's not something that was just discovered 10 years ago in Slovenia or Italy or whoever is claiming it.
Right. It's their culture.
As
you said, 8,000 years.
Yeah,
right?
And they're reviving it because during the Soviet years, a lot of the vines were torn out. And the winemaking practices tended to be pushed towards the direction of sweetness since the major market was Russian. And the Russians had, at that time, they're getting more sophisticated now, but a taste for sweeter wines. Hmm. And so a lot of these old methods were somewhat lost. And then when the Soviet Union collapsed, a lot of foreign companies came in to do joint ventures, but they wanted the European style of winemaking, and they brought in lots of money to have steel casks and everything. But now there's this wonderful artisanal revival.
And they're actually using the kvevri?
Again, and now kvevri I think there's a waiting list because they can't produce enough for the demand for people who want to start doing it in the age-old way again.
Wow.
I mean, people always were making their own wine.
But so they still have a lot of these feasts. The feasts are still very popular.
Any occasion is cause for a feast. So I say I arrive or you arrive and you meet people, there will be a supra to honor your visit. Or someone gets good grades, you might decide to have a supra for that. They're very spontaneous.
And is it sort of like potluck? People bring things?
Oh, no.
It's always
no,
served no, no. by, they choose who's going to do the cooking? Or?
Well, I mean, someone decides to have people to dinner, and that is, it always somehow turns into a feast.
You quoted a little wonderful passage from the poet Rustavelli about feasting, and I printed it up so I can read it for you.
12th century.
Yeah, 12th century, Rustavelli, and about talking about all the feasts, and he says, "Spending on feasting and wine is better than hoarding our substance. That which we give makes us richer. That which we hoard is lost." So this is, I mean, I guess questioning how these people during such time of turmoil, and obviously they probably didn't have a lot, and they don't spend it on other things, they would rather spend it on hosting people to dinner and throwing big dinners, right?
Well, the idea is that a guest is a gift from heaven.
Right, the whole back to the hospitality.
Yeah, and also the Georgian creation myth that I start my book with. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, I do. You can please.
If there's time, I'll tell very briefly.
Right now.
Basically, the Georgians are sitting around feasting, and it is the beginning of the world, and God is going around creating the world, and he's giving different parts of the world to different people, and the Georgians are feasting, so he goes and gives away a lot. And he comes back after however many days it was, I guess, six days, seven days. And he looks and the Georgians are still sitting there feasting. And he says, "What have you done? I've given away all the world. And you're still sitting here and you didn't claim your portion. And now the only thing that's left is what I was saving for myself, the most beautiful part of the world." And they just looked at him and they said, "But God, we have been feasting and honoring you and giving thanks to you. And what could be a better way to spend time?" And so God gave them the part of the world that he had intended for himself. And that's how the Georgians came to live in Georgia in the most beautiful
God's country.
In God's country.
Well, that's absolutely beautiful. They, you also there, you mentioned that, or I can't remember who the poet is that said, "You go to Georgia and you come back a poet."
Oh.
You may not remember that, but
what I remember is Pushkin, you know, the great Russian national. No,
yeah.
He said that every Georgian dish is a poem.
Yes.
So I do remember that.
Now, this was anyone who goes to Russia and goes to Georgia comes back a poet.
Oh, well.
Well, I have to say,
I don't know how poetic I am right now.
Well, I will say that you certainly, having been to Georgia a couple of times, you came back a poet because...
Oh, more than a couple of times.
More than a couple. Yeah. See? You see? It took you maybe more than a couple. But I will say, reading some of those essays, they're not just straight descriptions, but they are very poetic. You really put a beautiful spin and a very... I don't know how to say it, but you sort of set it in a cultural mode that is beautiful and very descriptive.
Thank you, Linda.
So you did come back a poet.
Thank you.
You. one last thing that kind of caught my attention, and I'm not sure, maybe I didn't read on to find out why, but you said that there was one province, Racha, where for some reason or other, that's where all the best Georgian chefs come from. What is the reasoning behind that, or what's the?
I honestly can't answer that.
But that's what it is. They all come from this one region in particular.
Well,
not all.
Okay. You know, I wrote that 25 years ago. I have not gone on to research it. I don't think it's true anymore.
I would imagine not with the popularity of the culture and the
right.
food.
So, there were some famous chefs who came from there. It is a remote province, and I think that what I would say now is that it's because they were exposed to really interesting food ways there that hadn't been influenced so much by outside forces. But I can't really answer that with intelligence.
Well, that leads up to my final question and last point, and that is, those who go and travel to Georgia today, will they find this experience? Are there still these old ways an old tradition existing? Will they find, kind of feel and get in touch a bit with the old culture?
I'd say that if you travel independently, you will. Because you'll meet people, the Georgians are wonderfully friendly, and they'll invite you in, and they'll regale you, even if you can't speak a common language. If you go with a tour group, you will be shown these things. Feasts will be organized for you in restaurants, so you'll taste Georgian food, to be sure, and you'll have fantastic, sensual sensory taste experiences, but you won't necessarily get into people's homes.
Mm-hmm. So, what about, is any agritourism existing that you know of?
There is some, and there are a couple of companies that are more focused on culinary experience that I think would be the way. If you feel the need to go with a group. But I actually think it's a very approachable country.
Yeah, I mean, not terribly large, as long as you do your research ahead of time.
Yeah.
And your book is a very good place to start.
And get a driver. Don't try to drive by yourself.
Dangerous roads up those mountains, right?
Yeah.
High peaks, yes. The Caucasus are not to be messed with, right? Well, it is just a joy, once again, to talk to you, always a font of knowledge, and in-depth knowledge, and I so appreciate it.
It was fun, Linda. Thanks so much for having me.
And what a great book. So it's a new edition, the 25th edition of The Georgian Feast, and University of California Press. And it's just such a treat and such a treasure. And
thank you
so much. And thank you for listening. Once again, this has been A Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.